At this point, barely 1 week into the General Assembly's 2019 session, no one, of course, can say with certainty how the next 4 months will turn out. There are, however, a few people who can come pretty darn close, not because of their ability to divine the future, but rather because of their ability to shape the future. I'm referring to the state's legislative leadership, a collection of individuals who can and do exert considerable influence thanks to powers bestowed by statute as well as chamber and caucus rules, and reinforced by the less formal, unwritten rules of political expediency, if not political survival. Hi, I'm John Schwantes, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll size up the 2019 session with four of the General Assembly's highest-ranking decision-makers. So don't go away. Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue researchers are at the top edge of computer technology, 3D design, using hand gestures, extending mobile battery life, leading through innovation and job creation. Purdue Research Foundation. Contact innovation at prf.org.
The General Assembly's 2019 session began just over a week ago with 21 new members, 16 in the House and 5 in the Senate. The arrival of so many newcomers, most of them first-time office holders, introduces a degree of unpredictability and promises to test the ability of legislative leaders to keep their respective caucuses focused on the established agenda. What happens, though, when two of the General Assembly's four caucus leaders are also new to their roles? We'll explore that question and many more with today's roundtable guests. I am pleased to welcome House Speaker Brian Bosma, an Indianapolis Republican; House Minority Leader Phil Giaquinta, a Fort Wayne Democrat; Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray, a Martinsville Republican; and Senate Minority Leader Tim Lannon, an Anderson Democrat. Thank you all for being here. I greatly appreciate it. On Organization Day, Brian Bosma, back around Thanksgiving,
right,
you had some advice for the newcomers, and you said, go find an old rule book, pour over the rule book, you'll understand how this place works a little bit better when you come back for the start of the session last week. Now, as you look at your new counterpart or fencing partner across the table here, Phil Giaquinta, he knows, he's been around more than a decade, he doesn't need to know the rule book, but he is new to his leadership role, this leadership role. What do you need to know?
We've actually chatted and had a couple of opportunities to exchange some advice. And one of the things I said, and I think you might have gotten from John Gregg, former speaker, and some others, was if you're going to move some of the deck chairs, you should do it now and put people in places that you're very comfortable with, and tap into the talents of your many members, including the new folks. And I think that's precisely what Phil's doing. And we'll try to lead our respective caucuses and the General Assembly in the right direction to do what's right for Hoosiers, even on those rare occasions where we'll disagree about that approach.
Rare occasions when you're going to disagree, right?
You know what? So we need to say this. About 95% of what will ultimately be adopted this session of the General Assembly by the House and the Senate will be bipartisan. It will have Republican and Democrat.
You know, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court always says, but it's those 5%. That are the ones that actually matter.
Well, they're certainly the ones that will be in the media.
Yeah. That's true. Right. What about that advice, do you think?
It's great advice. I've spoken to the speaker. I've spoken to former Speaker Pro Tem David Long as well. But the advice I've given to our veteran members and our newbies is to continue to reach out to the chairs of the Republican chairs of those committees that they're serving on. So it is very good advice. I think, and I've seen this in past session, new members, I think, have a way of working with the new members on the other side and forge friendships, relationships to, I think, come up with pretty good legislation. So I'm really kind of anxious to see what the newbies are going to do.
So unlike Congress in Washington, there is still, I think we can all attest to the fact that there are some efforts that cross partisan divides in the Indiana State House. Yeah. Tim Lannon, again, you've been around in your role for a while.
Yeah.
As we look at Roderick Bray, again, he's not a legislative rookie. He's been around, in your case, since 2012?
Yes, elected in 2012.
But again, relatively new to your role.
Right.
Give him what he needs to know.
I agree with everything that the speaker said, first of all. But, in addition to that, like you say, Rod's been around. People know him. I'd say Rod should just be himself, because he comes in with, I think, an expectation that he's a very reasonable person, a person that gets along well with everybody, including members of the other side. He's open-minded, and I think that's a great approach to how we try to legislate in the certainly in the Indiana Senate, I think in the Indiana General Assembly as well. So I don't have a whole lot of advice that I need to give to Rod. He's going to be fine, and I think the issue comes when you've got your first sort of crisis, and then you have to really think, well, how do I handle this? Do I do something different than what I usually would do on this? But I would urge Rod just to be himself. He'll be fine.
Well, and they may be leadership rookies, but they both have something relatively unique, that they both had fathers in the General Assembly. And not only that, but you both succeeded your respective fathers in the seats you now occupy.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's in the blood, I guess.
Maybe so.
Don't need advice from these interlopers
here.
You were there when they having your diaper changed on his old desk. Come on. All right. So you've all been nice.
That was not a pretty picture.
I'm sorry. The General Assembly sausage making never is. We've got the niceties out of the way. It sounded like we were just reliving Organization Day when all these calls came for bipartisan cooperation. Is that how realistic is that? I mean, you came out with your agenda, and just a short time later, Phil Giaquinta, you had a colorful description of the House GOP agenda, suggesting it's thunderous in its nothingness.
So did where's I say the, that?
Yeah, I think well, either that or your speechwriter did. Okay. I guess so. Is it the kumbaya moment that we're still living in, or how's this going to shake out for real? Let's. Since those were your words or attributed to you, which is the real Phil Giaquinta?
Well, I do think that we have we have serious issues to tackle, and I think there are definitely going to be some disagreements with how to go about how to solve these things. For example, House Bill 1003 that was discussed yesterday with regards to teacher pay. How I think we agree that we would like to see. Pay increase for teachers. How we get there will probably be some disagreements. When we look at, for example, the school funding formula that comes out for Fort Wayne Community Schools, the number there, frankly, just isn't enough, even though you keep your operating expenses at 10% or lower, which is what I believe, or 15% or lower,
I think
whatever.
That legislation you're talking about would be a target.
Right.
Of
It's going to be difficult to do with the allotted amount of money that comes through the school funding formula. So that's really, I think, where the debate's going to end up being. And so how we get there, while we agree on we need to get there, how we do it is going to be. Debatable.
I'm sure you'd balk at the notion that it's thunderous in its nothingness, but the top, and this goes for Senate Republicans too, or almost every caucus, certainly Republican side, has mentioned an honest, balanced budget as our top priority. But isn't that, I know you've received some ribbing from your Democratic counterparts, especially since that's now, as of just recent months, in the last election, ratified by voters, that's now part of the Constitution. So that's like saying we're going to I mean, is that truth, justice, the American way? Fight for motherhood and brotherhood?
It wasn't until my first speakership. We had a $750 million over expenditure from revenues. We had dipped deeply into reserves. And we had another $700 million of unfunded obligations that were coming ahead. So when I said for the first time in 2003 that we needed an honestly balanced budget without gimmicks and tax increases, it was sort of new news. People said, oh, it's always balanced. It was not balanced. It is now. Now it's a constitutional amendment. And I feel good about that achievement.
When does it stop becoming an agenda item, though, that shows up before every session?
Well, it wasn't just to be honestly balanced. It was to focus money on the Department of Child Services, teacher salaries, and school funding. So it was not just that statement. It was about the underlying priorities. And then we had a list of 10 bills that were surely, or nine in addition to the budget, that were surely not thunderous in their nothingness. In fact, cutting edge, and it attaches to the agenda that the Senate Republicans have announced, that I've seen, with a few exceptions, the Senate Democrats, and what Phil and others in the House Democrat caucus have talked about, too. Veteran pension exemption, tax exemption, more pay. We have three measures for more pay for teachers, school safety, and Department of Child Services, other infant mortality. I mean, this is a strong agenda group.
The difference is, as you look at Tim Lanham, and he can address this, might be, for instance, the call for legalized marijuana and a call for a requirement that insurance companies that do business in Indiana honor pre-existing conditions. I mean, those are two that certainly are departures from.
That's right, and those are important parts of our priorities, and we've put those out there. We hope they get serious consideration. You know, if nothing else, the public needs to know that these are issues that are important to the Senate Democratic Caucus. And many, many people in the state of Indiana believe both of those issues should be something the state should tackle. Now, whether we actually get there or not, you know, that's up to the supermajorities to decide. But on many of these issues, I'm hopeful. For example, on teacher pay, I think we all agree Indiana is lacking. We are behind all the other surrounding states. It's something our caucus has talked about for a long time. It seems the issues are going to be in the details of when do we do it. We think we ought to do it this budget cycle, correct, as opposed to kicking the can down the road a little bit further. And then how do we accomplish that? We think there's money in to be found to do that. And I know that Representative Porter came out yesterday and had 8 or 9 different ways by which we could get that money available in this budget cycle, rather than saying to teachers, yes, you're deserving of a pay increase, oh, but it's going to be, you know, a couple more years before we actually get there. We just don't think we can wait that long. And, of course, Department of Education Superintendent McCormick agrees that we need to do something this budget cycle. So it's going to be those type of details. But I think there's broad agreement we have to address these issues, whether it's teacher pay, DCS, hate crimes. These are all big issues upon which I think we all agree we ought to accomplish something, hopefully this year.
And that's
where
the devil is not only in the details. That is where, I mean, that's really where the breakdown occurs. Let's take one of, you know, an example there with teacher increases. You mentioned all of these budgetary priorities, but mm-hmm. with what, maybe $800 or so million dollars in additional funds projected for the biennium, that's not enough to go for built-in increases in Medicaid funding, certainly, and then Department of Child Services in all likelihood, which needs $286 million a year,
Give you one alternative to that, which I think Representative Porter identified yesterday, which is this $1 billion that the governor negotiated an increase in the toll road. Why shouldn't we have some say as to what is the priority of the use of that? So that's a real issue I think we need to look at. And we have various other ways by which we think we can find and fund the money for teacher increases in this budget.
Of course, then you've got to figure out how to make the school districts actually pass it on, since they're the ones who negotiate through collective bargaining agreements and budgeting processes at the local level, unlike some other states, how much teachers will be paid.
Well, that's the real challenge that you get to on that issue. I think we have an accord here at this table that teachers are a priority, and we need to find ways to fund them so that we attract more teachers into the profession and keep the ones that we have. But the challenge is when we start talking about, we want to add to teacher pay, you know, right now school districts have elected school boards. We have to be very sensitive to the fact that we don't want to invade the purview of that authority, because they make those decisions on how those funds get distributed. All we do at the state level is make sure, or we kind of designate how much a school district will get, and those elected school board members are there for the purpose of distributing out that money, including the teacher pay. So we want to be careful of that.
And that's one of the education budget items that might be there. Certainly, we're looking at school funding or funding for school safety measures after some of the tragedies we've seen around the country and, sadly, even here in Indiana. But it looks, at least to hear the governor describe it, that we might be frozen at the $14 million in additional funding that we saw in the last biennium. And, of course, Democrats have called for an expansion of the pilot program for pre-K, which is now, 3,000 or so students across 20 counties.
Right.
I mean, how serious are you, or how much political capital can you, well, you're a super minority, I guess, you can expend whatever capital you want. It might not make a difference. But how important are, which is, I just mentioned three education priorities.
Yeah.
How do those stack up for you?
Well, we've seen tremendous success with Indiana's pre-K program so far. And it's time that we roll it out statewide. When you talk about issues that affect things that are happening 15 years down the road, it all starts with pre-K, in my opinion, with our youth and kids that are 3 and 4 and 5 years old. Because there's so many problems that happen when they're at that age, which develop then into opioid use and other kinds of things that are leading to the crime situation that we're seeing across the state. But we have seen tremendous success with the pre-K program, and it's really about time. And why only 20 counties that we have? Let's roll it out statewide. It's way past time to do that.
Well, again, all of these things sound great. Certainly you would all agree, but again, dollars attached to them.
So let me just address that one. I agree 100% with what was said about the importance of it. It's expensive. It's more expensive to have a pre-kindergartner in a pre-K program for a full year, because these are not school year programs, than it is for a high school student or a grade school student. So this is a significant investment, which we must make, but it's not going to, can't be made all at once, because it's $300 million.
And well, I would say it's less expensive to do that than to deal with the problems that we have to deal with down the road with the issues that teenagers and face, or they aren't able to get the jobs that we want them to do and things like that. So I think the investment up front is going to save us money in the long run.
But again, it comes down to the appetite for doing these programs versus the fiscal realities. You alluded, sticking with education for a moment, earlier to HB 1003, which, as I understand it, would, rather than try to squeeze more money out of the state's general fund for education or arguably for teacher increases, it would actually put a little bit of pressure on local districts by setting targets of 85% of state dollars would go toward instruction.
Exactly right.
So is that as good as it? I mean, and that is $5 million or more, according to your estimates, but is that... Does that take the place of actually upping the overall funding?
No. It is the beginning of a solution. We obviously have to put more money into education. I think we will put significantly more in the budget that we're going to be considering here in the next week in the House, and that will be the proposal. But we have to also put pressure on local school administration to get money to the teachers. I'm going to use some blanket statistics because every school district is different. Some place as much as 95% of the funds received from the state into salaries. Some as little as 40%. So we've got, for reasons, you know, that are no doubt justifiable, but we need to give encouragement to local units to get that money to the most important professionals in our state, and that is school teachers.
So as we talk about this, my internal cash register keeps, the tab keeps getting higher and higher. You mentioned, Tim Lannon, a few moments ago, the $100 billion. I just upped the ante. Boy, our problems are
nice
over.
Yeah.
The $1 billion agreement that the governor negotiated with the vendor who operates the Indiana Toll Road in return for an ability to increase tolls on trucks, $1 billion, which the governor has already earmarked. That alone, that's not even going to solve the problems as much as that is. What else are you prepared to see happen? How about the proposed increase on the tax on cigarettes, as much as $2 a pack, most of which might go to cessation, but others could go into the general fund? Or what? Do you have any other ideas for revenue enhancement?
Well, I think there's a number of ideas that I said yesterday. I think Representative Porter put out a list of about 9 ideas that we could take a look at, and we take all those together. Now, some of them may be feasible, some may not be, but they all add up. I mean, you could start with the idea that we're going to roll back the tax breaks that we've been given to the corporations and the financial institution tax that continues to be rolled out, and maybe that's something we ought to put the brakes on. And I know that that's millions of dollars; it's not billions of dollars, but you can find this money, and even the $1 billion that you're talking about. The problem I have there is the governor just unilaterally made a determination: here's how we're going to spend that money. Well, I thought that was our job as the General Assembly, as the fiscal body, to fashion a budget. And we could take a look at, if teacher increases, if you're looking at a 3% or a 5% increase, which I think is something we've looked at, a couple $100 million. It's real money.
I get that. You want to roll it into ongoing operating expenses, and that can only result in a tax increase in the future.
Rob Bray, are you and your caucus willing to entertain perhaps revisit the proposed distribution of that $1 billion that we just alluded to, or are you willing to entertain tax increases on cigarettes, or are you willing to entertain some of the other proposals that Democrats have put forth, which basically deal with stopping, reversing, rolling back some of the business corporate tax breaks, which have been phased in over the past, 10 years or so?
Yeah, 10 years. Maybe
are you willing to consider any of those, or is that off the table?
Well, I think about everything is on the table to talk about, whether it's revenue generation, but mostly we have to be responsible with the funds that we have and how we spend them. You know, if you start talking about rolling back some of those corporate taxes, you know, that begins to we begin to lose pace in our competitiveness and our ability to attract business here to the state of Indiana, which the governor's had incredible success doing over the last few years. You know, every time you open up the paper or turn on the television, there's another announcement about new jobs coming to the state of Indiana. So much to the point now that one of our biggest challenges is trying to come up with the workforce to fill those jobs. So, you know, I think those are paying dividends for us and have now for a little while. But, we absolutely have to make sure that we prioritize how we're going to spend our funds. That's why the budget is job one every 2 years.
And of course, the governor has suggested that in an attempt to create that kind of atmosphere which is conducive to job growth and relocation perhaps of other companies to our state, he says quality of life is a big issue. The bias crimes issue, making people feel welcome, that's certainly part of what he has advocated. We'll see from the State of the State address coming week just how much he's willing to back that. Your caucus has said this is the time that Indiana needs to get off the list of five states don't have any bias crimes
legislation. We've been pushing that for a long time. Again, I think there's going to be, by and large, a consensus. We need to do something on bias crimes. What is it? Well, you know, we've proposed, Senator Taylor has his bill, which calls for an enhancement way to approach as opposed to looking at aggravating circumstances. Our feeling is, I guess if you ask any prosecutor worth their salt, which would you rather have, an aggravator or an enhanced sentence that you could go to as an option, they would say give us the enhanced sentence because we think that's a more meaningful statement as to what the policy is you're trying to enforce. This is an important debate we're going to have. As long as it's a meaningful bill that gets passed, I've got a little bit of a problem with the House bill that came out. I looked at it and I thought, man, this looks like a lot of legal gobbledygook. Why don't we just bite the bullet, say here are the classes in which we're going to make a determination, here's the approach we're going to take, and not leave it up in the air as to what are we really trying to do here. Indiana needs to really have a meaningful hate crime.
Well, this is one of those where we've talked about the devil being in the details of so many issues. This perhaps is the quintessential example of that, whether you include gender identification, which you've suggested shouldn't be in there.
Well, let me clarify. I suggested that it was going to be tough to pass with it in there. That's been misrepresented by one media outlet as my personal opinion, the only thing I would entertain, and that's not the context. In fact, the four of us were on stage talking about the session at the Chamber of Commerce, I think, or one of the appearances that we make, and I said, look, here's what I think can pass. I think if you have gender identity in there, I don't know that you're going to pass two supermajority of conservative Republican chambers, and suggested that that might be a stumbling block. I think Greg Sturwald has come up with a very positive alternative that allows the hate crime aggravator to apply to every citizen of the state if the crime is, it's concluded the crime was affected because of the person's trait or membership or characteristic, then you don't have to be added to a list.
Some would say too broad. Is that, Phil James?
Well, I would suggest Speaker controls the agenda, but I would suggest let's put it up on the board.
You read the rules book.
I did. I figured that out 12 years ago. But no, let's put it up on the board and see if we can't get 51 votes for that.
Let me ask Rod Bray, too, because you raised some eyebrows when you took some of those bills that were related to the subject matter and put them to Rules Committee, which you happen to chair.
Right.
Now, historically, that's a place where you kill legislation. You said, no, that's not the case. Explain.
Well, that wasn't my intent. I put these in rules so we could begin to have a conversation, because we've had a couple of different versions of the bills that have been filed. So we'll put those in there and begin to discuss it as a caucus. And we'll have an opportunity as the session goes along to kind of fully vet these. But, you know, the issue doesn't come down to who is on that list and is that the right people to have on the list. At least for me, the issue is the issue of a list and identity politics the way to continue to bring Hoosiers together, or having a more broad perspective like Sturwald's bill is a little bit that way with it, that talks about if a crime is committed based on a motive that deals with somebody's association in a group or some other character or class that they're in, then maybe that's the wrong thing. So maybe keeping it more general is a way to bring us more together rather than to divide us all up into lists, some of whom are on the list and some of whom are not.
I'm going to hate to do this because you all think 61 days for the long session is short. Just think of the 21 minutes or whatever we're devoted to this conference. It really happens fast.
Right.
But I do think we've moved beyond nothing, thunderous nothingness. We've addressed some important issues, and I thank you all for taking the time to share your thoughts and perspectives with the citizens of the state of Indiana. Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Brian Bosma of Indianapolis, Democratic Representative Phil Giaquinta of Fort Wayne, Republican Senator Roderick Bray of Martinsville, and Democratic Senator Tim Lannon of Anderson. Fresh on the heels of his State of the State address, we'll have our annual conversation with Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for one of my favorite parts of the show, our weekly debrief with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, a division of Hanna News Service. Lots of new faces. What impact will that have?
Well, you heard the legislators talk about how three of them were actually legacies. Their fathers were in the General Assembly. And these were guys that spent a long time there, that had a strong record there, and gives the sons a real respect for the institution. And it's not just kind of a transitory kind of service. There's a sense of public service instilled in them, and I think that's going to come across this session.
The notion that it's a tool to be used to improve government, not something to be torn down.
Yeah, and they also saw their fathers serve in a time when we really were involved more in comity than in confrontation, and I think that's also a helpful thing to have.
You know, we always discuss, you know, is it tougher to be a minority leader or a majority leader when you have the supermajority, looks good on paper, but then you got to keep all the cats herded. Are the Republicans in lockstep? How much so heading into this session?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough thing for the Speaker and for the President pro tem. You know, we saw earlier this week, just with the very first big bill that got heard, the education bill, that the Republicans aren't all on the same page. And they also have to worry that a couple of their state elected officials are not necessarily going to be in step with the governor and with the legislative leaders. The superintendent of public instruction, Jennifer McCormick, wasn't necessarily singing from the same song sheet as the speaker on the education bill, and Attorney General Curtis Hills had his issues with leaders and leadership as well.
How does this all shake out? I know it's early to get a prediction, yeah. and it's impossible to say, but good session, something productive coming out of this?
Well, I'm sure we'll have a productive session, but you've got so many nuances and not enough money to spend. It's going to be a tough one.
All right. We'll leave it there. Talk to you next week, Ed. Thanks. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Chuanis. On behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and my colleague Ed Feigenbaum, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more on what promises to be a very interesting legislative session. Until next week, take care.
What if a robotic arm could help disabled students reach for their dreams? It does. Introducing RoboDesk. To learn more about this and more than 400 other world-changing Purdue technologies, visit otc-prf.org.